Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 22, Audiophile Philosophy. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is John Iverson, self-titled Web Monkey for Source Interlink, which publishes my websites and Stereophile.com, among others, which makes him my boss. So I better be on my best behavior. He also writes for Stereophile, and he's a musician who's recorded a CD of Indonesian-inspired music called Alternesia on the MA Recordings label. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, very glad to have you on. You are clearly from the audiophile camp. I've described you before as a lifelong audiophile.
Yep.
So yeah, clearly, the quality of recorded music is very important to you, which is certainly evident in your CD, which I know you recorded there in the very room I believe you're in right now.
Yeah, in fact, we had I had bought a modified MCI 2-inch 16-track machine. So it's an old analog machine from about 1973 or so. And recorded everything directly onto that multi-track with some nice custom-made tube mic preamps and so forth. But the point being is that I didn't need a fancy studio to do it. We just had to be real careful about the miking and the acoustics when we were doing so. And then the mixing, and mixed it straight to 2-channel. And then MA Recordings is a real nice audiophile label. So they did a great job with producing the CD at that point. I think it was printed and pressed in Japan.
Yes, Todd, forgotten his last name now.
Garfinkel, Todd Garfinkel.
Todd Garfinkel, yes, who I knew, yeah, believe it or not, at Cal State Northridge. Be now close to 30 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
But he's been in Japan. I think he moved back, actually, but he was in Japan for a long time, and that's where he ran his label.
Yeah, yeah, he had an office in L.A. and also out of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see behind you that you have quite an LP collection.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll move out of the way.
How long have you been? Yeah, I do. It's quite amazing, actually. How many have you got?
I couldn't tell you exactly. There's, I don't know, thousands. It's a wall full. That closet, actually, when we built this house, we built the closet. And it's climate controlled, and it's got a double pane glass sliding door in the front to keep the humidity and the temperature somewhat even inside there. And then all the records are wrapped in plastic. So I'm planning on holding on to them for the long run. That's for sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
You built a closet, a climate controlled closet for your LPs.
Well, you kind of need to, actually, because the vinyl itself is not going to deteriorate so fast. But the covers, of course, which are made out of plastic, or glue rather, and paper, those will have problems over time. So what you tend to want to do is isolate the album cover from the elements. You also want to make sure that the album itself, the vinyl inside, isn't going to contact anything, say a bad plastic in the record sleeve that's going to deteriorate the vinyl itself over time. So all those things, you kind of get it in archival shape, put it in the closet, and then keep it there.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, LPs used to be the medium on which music was distributed, and then they got supplanted by CDs. And I thought they more or less disappeared until I started hanging around with real audiophiles like you and John Atkinson, who was a guest earlier, and going to trade shows, at least audiophile trade shows, where LPs are still quite a booming business.
Well, actually, Michael Fremmer, of course, is the big advocate at Stereophile. And yes, according to him, LPs are going to retake over the world. But, you know, somewhere between what he says and the fact that they did die out in the mid-90s or so is the truth. And a lot of new music is actually released on LP. I mean, people really like the idea of the package. It's large, it's tactile. And we could talk about the sound, of course, which is, you know, where my interest is. But I think the newer kids who are dealing with LP as a kind of an almost archaic, unusual format for them, as opposed to someone like myself or yourself who we grew up in, that was our high school format. But for the younger kids who are picking it up for the first time, I think they recognize the value in the package as well as the sound.
But aren't they significantly less convenient than CDs or nowadays MP3s and downloads?
Yeah, well, okay, so that's an interesting point, because the issue always with formats is, you know, what's the advantage of the new format, and bringing forward the next format, what's its new advantage? And generally, sound quality has not been what they focus on. They may say so in the marketing materials, but typically the new format, the idea is give people something they could recognize as different and is easier to use or somehow is more compatible with their lifestyle or what they're doing. And LPs are definitely not that format. I mean, at this point, you know, how many people, if they want to keep an archive of records, are going to put a closet together? But even more so, I've got a record cleaning machine, which is not unusual for people to have, that I wet clean and vacuum the record if I want to play a record that's been sitting in there for a while. You know, the turntable, you need to get that set up right. You need to, there's a lot of physics involved in aligning your cartridge and making sure that everything is set up properly with your tone arm. And then at that point, you got to get the record out and put it on the turntable, let it play 20 minutes. When it's over, pick the arm up, start it, turn it over, start it up again, and, you know, listen another 20 or 30 minutes. For people like myself who were used to sitting down and listening that way, 20 minutes was a great time to sit down and listen. And LPs were sequenced in such a way that they were made to go from minute one to minute 20 in a very particular way, so that it would kind of take you through a journey musically or emotionally. And with a 60-minute CD, it's a little tougher to sit down and listen to something for 60 minutes without wanting to get up and kind of move around and so forth. So the LP lends itself to somewhat more of a sedentary listening style, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned audio quality, and I really do want to get into that.
I don't want to minimize that idea, because that's actually the real reason that a lot of people go to the trouble of LPs.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the difference in audio quality between LPs and CDs?
Yeah, well, that's tough. I mean, in general, what people like to say is, CDs maybe are a little bit drier, a little bit more impersonal sounding. LPs are warmer. That's a term that's used a lot. Analog is a warmer, more euphonic kind of a sound. But, you know, we're dealing with a reproduction of a musical event. And in a lot of cases, that reproduction has been processed and gone through a lot of changes. So sometimes what's on the vinyl record or on the CD is not necessarily representing reality. It's representing an artistic vision of something that happened. And so for a lot of people, the turntable vinyl will, in a sense, enhance that artistic expression of the music, whereas maybe CD might be a little bit too cold analytical. Maybe it's something that doesn't have the kind of feeling where when you turn it up, you want to turn it up louder and louder. I mean, that's probably the first thing I noticed when I was starting to listen to CDs back in the mid-80s was I tended not to want to turn the CDs up louder and listen to them for longer. I tended to want to listen to them for a couple minutes and maybe turn it down a bit, but generally not want to turn it louder and start stamping my feet, which I would do with albums. So I guess what I'm getting at is there's almost an emotional thing with vinyl. Mm-hmm. You can get more emotionally involved with the music if you're so inclined, and I find that to be the case with better CD players these days too as well.
Mm. that leads me to an interesting question. I've heard it said, and I have yet to find the real definitive research on this, that compressed music, what people are listening to a lot these days, MP3s in particular, where you can throw away as much as 90% of the information, the audio information, have less emotional impact even than uncompressed digital. And what you're saying is that uncompressed digital might have less emotional impact than analog vinyl. Have you read anything about this?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting point. I guess it depends on, I mean, we're throwing a lot of terms out like compression and so forth. There's two types of compression. I mean, I don't want to get too technical, but there's dynamic range compression, where you're limiting the loud versus the soft passages of a piece of music or an audio signal. But there's also digital data compression. So,
yes, okay, good. Let's make a distinction between these two.
So the data compression, there's two ways you do it. One's called lossy compression, which is what an MP3 is. So literally, you're using tricks and algorithms to throw away a bunch of the data so that you can have a smaller stream of music, a little bit lower rent stream of music, less overhead, but to try to get as close as you can to representing the original waveform. So you're cheating in a way, and you're hoping that people don't notice. Then there's loss. Yeah, there's lossless compression. And what that means is that you're compressing the signal, but you're using tricks that don't throw away actual original data. You're using tricks that compress the nature of the digital stream. Typically, for example, the FLAC, F-L-A-C format. There was some other formats when we went to high-res audio that were used to compress. These were lossless compression, where when they reconstructed the waveform, the original bits and data were still all there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about compression, a turntable, and let's bring it back to the turntable versus, say, the download. Mm-hmm. The turntable artifact won't be a compression of data in terms of it's not throwing data out. It's an analog signal.
Right.
But what might be happening is it might be compressing the dynamic range. Now, interestingly enough, there's a tool in the recording studio a lot of people are familiar with, which is a compressor. Mm-hmm. And that's used as an artistic choice to actually make an instrument maybe sound better. It evens out the volume, especially on drums and bass. So, you know, the classic example people will know from the 60s is Ringo Starr's drum set was compressed in a particular way that just made it sound good. And it didn't sound like a real drum set sitting in your living room. You know, no offense to George Martin, but what he knew to do was to compress it in such a way. And certain microphones have compression techniques. I noticed just listening to you talking on this podcast, your microphone, I can hear the compression characteristic of your microphone, which makes your voice sound different than how it sounds when I hear you in person.
Right.
So an analog turntable, I mean, I'm going to probably offend Michael Fremmer to a certain extent because I know he advocates the accuracy of vinyl in an analog sense. But I do believe that there is a little bit of euphonic compression that takes place and in the analog chain, and that could be pleasing. When I recorded my disc, it was actually recorded intended for CD, but I recorded it on analog tape, and it was a 2-inch tape format, in particular because I liked the, if you will, the sonic characteristics of that recording medium, and compression, a slight compression of the signal actually was part of that. And so when you're recording digitally straight onto your laptop, say, or Pro Tools or whatever, you know, technically the representation is more literal in terms of the digital sample of the waveform. Now your microphone is going to be compressing a little bit just by nature of the diaphragm used to a different type of microphone preamp. But, you know, that aside, you're not, the medium is a little bit more transparent when you're recording to digital. There's other artifacts and things you got to pay attention to, but you don't get that warmth. And so, you know, it can be an artistic choice at some point.
Sure, sure. Analog tape certainly does have some inherent dynamic range compression. It's particularly more forgiving at the high end of the dynamic range, where if as you're saturating the tape with a very loud or high amplitude signal, it gently starts to compress. Whereas if you're recording digitally, you get up to a certain amplitude, and if you go even the smidgest bit, tiniest bit above that, you're going to start clipping, you're going to start having aliasing artifacts, you're going to start having all kinds of horrible stuff. So in that sense, analog recording is more forgiving, and perhaps that is one of the reasons you chose to use analog as your original recording medium.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, when I recorded that album 10 years ago, digital hadn't gotten to the point where actually I liked the way it sounded, although now I'm more inclined to record digitally. But to your point, though, yes, there was a certain, because the album I recorded was largely mostly all percussion. Indonesian music is metal percussion instruments, so it's a very tough thing to record. And the analog tape really makes it sound nice. I mean, it adds its own little compression sense to the signal, and that really helps. You know, so once again, an artistic choice. Now, interestingly enough, I was recording that, and I knew that for a CD. I've been around recording long enough that I've recorded things that ended up on LP several times, and that required a whole different attitude in the sense of you knew going into it that when you recorded on analog tape, that once they mastered it and then cut it for an LP, you were going to lose things in the process from the master tape to the cutting and the pressing of the disc. Mm. And so, you know, they've actually gotten it's funny how these things evolve. Pressing and cutting discs has gotten better even as the format has died. But, you know, back in, say, the late 70s, mid 80s when I was doing it, you still had to brighten up the top end a little bit to compensate for losses and so forth. So it was actually frustrating recording for vinyl LP in the sense that what you heard on your master tape in the studio, you lost something as soon as you got the record back from the pressing plant. You lost something. You knew it wasn't the same. Now, You know, there's arguments about, well, with the CD, you lose something else that's more important that you don't lose with the LPs. So therefore, you know, still. But I think with any medium, if you're not listening to the master tape as it comes off the machine in that recording studio, you're dealing with, in a sense, a somewhat of a fluid, you know, a fluid playback environment. You're dealing with more variables, and so accuracy becomes a really tough thing to chase. I mean, you're chasing your tail around in circles at some point.
I know John Atkinson and others on the podcast have said that really recorded music should not be considered to be a reproduction of a live acoustic event. It can never be that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and so accuracy, in a sense, is a false goal.
Well, there's a phrase I use often when people want to start talking about this, and it's a philosophical question I pose to them, which is, so when you're recording, or say when you're listening in your home, are you bringing the environment that the music was recorded in into your living room? Or are you transporting your living room to that environment?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like just a mind trick, really. It's not something that has to do with changing the way you hear a recording. But if philosophically what you're trying to do is put the musicians in somebody's living room as opposed to transport that person to the venue, you might have you're going to have a different approach to how you make a recording based on what your goal is there. So there are some recordings that I literally feel as though the musicians have been placed in my room. I remember, you know, one of the first albums that stuck out was Sonny Rollins' Way Out West. Do you remember that disc?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is from the late 50s. And it was one of those albums where there was three instruments. I mean, saxophone, bass, and drums. And they were recorded fairly dry in a studio. You play that on a good system, it sounds like there's three guys standing in your living room. And so whatever your listening room sounds like, that's what that's going to sound like. You know, then there's other recordings like a Beatles disc, for example, where they put a lot of effects, they put a lot of environment around the recording. They're going to try to transport you to someplace and take you out of your environment. And so, you know, if we start getting into recording and the intent, there isn't one size fits all. There's a whole bunch of different ways to approach this.
Mm-hmm. So how does one then approach putting together an audio reproduction system in their home that might best serve both of those purposes?
Well, the first thing we have to just simply acknowledge and admit, and you know, I'll argue with anybody all day long about this, is there is no one system that does it for everybody. I mean, it's and I think that's frustrating for people who just want to say, okay, I want reality in my living room. Get me as close to reality. That's the state of the art, and that's the goal. But, you know, there's this variable of where they recorded the event and so forth and how they mixed it and the room that they mix it in, and then there's your room. Your room is such a huge component in what you're going to hear that since we don't all listen in exactly the same room, that's going to be a tough thing to eliminate out of the chain. Now, there's companies who are building products to try to eliminate the room effects. And, you know, we review those. These are products like Odyssey and so forth, which sample your room and try to somehow smooth out your room's particular characteristic. But ultimately, you've got different speakers, you've got different electronics, different amps. So what I try to explain to people is spend a little time trying to figure out what your preferences are, what you like, and so forth. Don't have somebody tell you, oh, you got to like this because it's analog. You got to hate this because it's an MP3. Figure out what kind of music you like, and then figure out how you like to hear that music and start with that. And, you know, over time, it's like anything. I mean, you know, food preferences change over time. I think your listening preferences will change over time.
So perhaps the audiophile approach really has to include doing a lot of listening to a lot of different kinds of systems and a lot of different kinds of music before you can really even begin to select what you might want to put in your own home. And ideally, listening to all those different systems and music in your own home, which probably not very many stores would allow you to do.
Right. No, you're right. And actually, this is starting to sound kind of fuzzy. And I think this is what puts a lot of people off from better sound, is the fact that, you know, you want to be able to trust somebody that says you need to buy the XYZ because this is the best sounding thing right now. And once you put this in your house, now you're caught up with everybody. And it's not that simple a thing. It's kind of like, in a way, you're getting involved in an art. And this is the odd thing about an audiophile's life, is you're combining technology, you're combining physics, and then you're also involving this emotional component in this art and trying to put them together and get a pleasing result. That's not a something that you just kind of toss off. You do it for a couple hours, boom, you're done. You go into something else. It can become a lifelong pursuit, obviously, for some of us, but it can also, I've watched this happen. You know, someone gets involved in audio and for 6 months, they're obsessed. They're chasing their tail, you know, as I say, going for all those little teeny fine details for months. And then all of a sudden they reach a point where I think they kind of get that 99% of what they want out of it. And then they turn off and they start listening to music again and they forget about the equipment for a while. And, you know, there's others who they're so enamored with the equipment and just kind of that whole culture, they'll stick with that for a long time. But I kind of find myself to be kind of in between, where I will spend a month or two obsessing about a particular part of my system. But then once I get that handled, I forget about it and just listen to music. So, you know, I spent a couple of months last year redoing my turntable, for example, arm, tone arm, cartridge. And I called people, I tried things, I called the dealers I knew, you know, I spent a lot of time on it. But once I got it set up, once I got it tweaked, I don't think about it anymore. I just play records. And so, you know, I think it's that initial stage of having to really figure out what you do want and getting in touch with your almost inner audiophile, and then manifesting that in your choices. And sometimes you make bad choices, which can be expensive. So that can be a tough thing. You've got to have a good sense of humor about it. You've got to, in a sense, you know, if the music compels you to do it, then it's easy. And that's, you know, I guess lucky for me, I'm so drawn towards music that I'm willing to suffer any indignity just to simply get something that I think brings me closer to that emotional response. But, you know, if you just want it now and you want it easy, that's tough. I mean, you know, maybe that's why an iPod and headphones is so good for a lot of people, because actually, you know, it puts the music in your head. And if you kind of set it up right, and if you've got the music that you like, it can be very satisfying.
Yeah, I've certainly noticed that quite a few audiophiles seem to be more concerned with the equipment than with the music itself, and which seems kind of bass-ackwards to me.
Well, yeah, although I try not to render judgment, only because, you know, for example, I've been reviewing DACs, digital audio converters for stereophile, and I'm not, you know, it's funny, I was raised in a household where my father was an electronic engineer. I grew up in Palo Alto. You know, I was part of the electronics club, the AV club, that kind of stuff. But I try not to get too involved in the geeky end of it or the technical end of it. I try to keep myself away from that. But when you're reviewing DACs, here's a product that basically all it does is convert the audio signal to an analog output that you can plug into your stereo system. So not a lot of features here. And so the technology all of a sudden starts getting important. All the little teeny things start mattering. So you start getting really focused on those little details. And when you do that, you can get obsessed technically, what you're talking about there, where you can spend a month focusing just on the technical side of it, because you got to get past that out to the other side before you can then, you know, relax and let it render music. But a couple of months ago in Stereophile, I put together an editorial, which they published. We published at the front page of every issue of Stereophile is something called an As We See It. And so different guest editors will provide one. So anyways, a couple of months ago, I did one where I was talking with Stephen Mejias, and we were talking about, you know, how some people, like you said, obsess on the equipment side. Some people can just care about music and they don't care how it sounds. And I started realizing there was basically three factors at play, which I boiled down to what was called MQE. So music, quality, and ease of use. And every person, and even one person throughout their life, the ratios of those three things and how much they matter to you changes. So you might have an M for music, you know, of 60%, and a Q for quality, say, of 20%, and, you know, 20% for convenience or ease of use. So you're really focused on the music, but maybe you're not so much focused on how it sounds. Where somebody who maybe doesn't really care about music, but they just love technology, well, their quality factor might be up to 60 or 70%. But, you know, over time, it might change. They might start becoming to get more involved with the music and so forth. But I think there's those three things that are always kind of in our head, and everybody has a different ratio. Everybody has a different emphasis. And I think that's kind of what makes it interesting in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've got a question from the chat room here from Floop. How are the loudness... F-Loop, sorry. How are the loudness wars, the trend towards more dynamic range over compression in popular records, impacting engineers and hi-fi? As we see more and greater dynamic range, is the equipment keeping up?
Well, you know, he brings up the loudness wars, and I don't want to misinterpret what he's looking for. The term loudness wars, as I've seen it used and as I use it, actually refers to mastering CDs or mastering digital music and, in a sense, compressing the dynamic range to make the disc louder. Because what happens is if you take the loud peaks off, you can kind of move the whole middle of the disc. You can kind of move it up. You can move the music that's in the middle and make it all a little bit louder, because the top end, the louder peaks are taken away, and so they're not distorting at the top end. So you can basically make the whole disc sound a little bit louder. But what that means is you have reduced the dynamic range. I mean, there's a couple of discs that came out a few years ago that were notoriously compressed and loud and just terrible hashy sounding. But you put that disc on the radio or you put it on your iPod, and it sounds louder than the song that just played before. And so it jumps out, it grabs your neck, it gets more attention. So mastering engineers a lot of times are told by the record label, by the producer, who knows who, but they're told, make this disc loud. I want it to jump out of the person's speakers and grab them by the throat. But that's at the expense of ultimately sound quality. So there's this dilemma. I mean, when you're mastering an album, you master it once. So do you master it loud to get the attention off the shoot and, you know, to get it to grab people off the radio? Or do you master it for the long run, where actually you try to make it sound as good as possible, preserve the dynamic range? So these loudness wars basically erupted where mastering engineers were trying to see who could come up with the loudest sounding disc without distorting on it. You know, so when you put it in your CD player, you might have your volume, say, set at 5, but one disc will sound louder than the other. And so the loudest disc wins in that battle. And unfortunately, sound quality loses. And I'm hoping that's something that doesn't continue. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of music on CD, for example, is remastered and re-released, say, every 10 years. So you've got, for example, I was just reviewing a component and I used a Roxy Music disc that came out in 1973. So it came out on CD, I think, in the late 80s. I had that version. They remastered it in early 90s. Then it came out again about 5 years ago. They remastered it. Now, in that particular case, each time they remastered it, they improved, in my opinion, the sound of the disc. There's other discs, however, where as they remaster them, they try to make them louder, and the newer versions actually sound worse than the original CD versions. And the loudness wars are largely to blame for that. So sometimes this is going to make it sound almost trivial in a sense, but you've got to buy three versions and the three different masterings, compare them yourself, and then toss the two you don't like. I mean, that's kind of what it's come down to.
They've done much the same thing with TV commercials. We've talked about this on the podcast as well, that you know, people always complain, and rightly so, that commercials, when you're watching TV, commercials end up being seeming so much louder than the program material. And it's not that they're that much louder in decibels. It's that they've compressed them so that they can keep the entire audio track at the maximum amplitude,
right,
and it therefore appears louder. Whereas the regular TV show has a wider dynamic range. It's got some quiet parts, you know, night scene on the street or whatever, compared to explosions. That's a much wider dynamic range than what you hear on the commercials, and that's how they do it.
Yeah, but I will use the example, since you brought up video and TV. I mean, the opposite can also be the problem. I'm sure you watch movies, and if you've got a really nice high-resolution video playback system, we're talking about the audio side of it. Some movies can have so much dynamic range that you can't hear the dialogue, and so you get the opposite problem where you have to turn it up so loud to hear the dialogue that when the explosion comes, it pins your face back against the chair, and then when your pant legs are flapping, and then you turn it down, but then you're having trouble hearing. So, you know, in reality, when we're walking around in the real world, we're really good at focusing our brain at what we want to listen to and pointing our head towards what we want to listen to or picking things out of a crowd. When you reproduce it in an environment, it doesn't quite work that way. And so you end up with this situation where the engineer has to figure out how much of reality do we want to represent. I mean, the classic example is if you record a group playing in a room from the typical distance that you'll sit back and listen to them at. And let's say you've got a string quartet in your living room and you listen, say, 20 feet back. So you put a microphone 20 feet back. It's going to sound so much different than how you think it actually sounded sitting 20 feet back, because you're all of a sudden getting all this room sound. Your brain is not focusing and eliminating all that room echo. You know, for example, I know you and I talking right now, I'm about 4 feet back, 3 feet back from my microphone, and I know you're up on a microphone pretty close. There's a lot of room echo you know, with my microphone, and there's probably less with yours. And yet, if somebody was in the room with each of us, we'd sound the same to them. And so this room effect and all that, you know, it's a tough thing to control. And so a lot of things are close mic'd. They put microphones right up on instruments. Once again, these are all artistic judgments. And so it's such a fluid thing, recording, sound quality, all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Another, we're getting all kinds of questions here. Who is it? Pad1563 asks, what is the best way to learn about mastering or to take a recording either live or multi-track and take it from an edited dry sound to a more professional sound? Clearly, there are plenty of classes and even schools that offer courses in this, and it's far more deep than we can address in any detail here. But any thoughts on that?
Oh, no, actually, that's an interesting question, because as a musician and recording engineer, I mean, I became a recording engineer out of necessity, because I couldn't afford, at the time in the 80s, I couldn't afford to spend $20,000 and go into a recording studio. So I started recording myself. But and to be clear, I'm here to talk about kind of the consumer side of things. I mean, a mastering engineer right. could really tell you the answer to that question. But what I've done is I've taken my recordings to a mastering engineer, somebody who I could talk to. And there's a lot of studios in pretty much every city in this country, it seems, in the United States, that have somebody who's got a decent mastering setup. And that might be a good place to start, because the important thing is to hear your music in a bunch of different environments. So that's probably the one answer, the practical answer I can give is that when you have something mixed, listen to it at your friend's house, listen to it on the car stereo, listen to it on the iPod, try to listen to it on a really good system. And see what it does on each of those systems. You might learn, you know, kind of what the effects of your choices are when you record, when you hear it in all those different environments.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good idea and general approach, because in the two or three albums that I've recorded with various groups, I've done exactly that. I've taken it out to the car and I've listened to it on a kind of a funky car system. I've listened to it on a really nice stereo, home stereo system. And, you know, in the studio, recording studio, which is a different environment altogether. So I agree, listening to on a bunch of different systems is really an excellent way to learn about what happens when you record music and what the final result is going to be. Because as you said earlier, you know, the room and ultimately the system has a huge impact on the final result, on the sound that you actually hear.
Well, you know, it's funny, but especially in the 70s when there was a wide range of recording environments, even professional ones, we would almost joke that we could figure out what speakers they mixed an album on, because if it had too much bass, that meant they mixed it on a pair of speakers that didn't have much bass. So, you know, little Oratones at the time, or the Yamaha NS10Ms.
Yeah.
If they didn't also compare to how it sounded on, say, the JBL 4311s, which had this, you know, nice boomy bass. So you mix an album on a pair of JBL 4311s, and I don't want to offend anybody who likes to use those as a reference, but they tend to have a pretty good bottom end. And so you would turn the bass down a little bit. So then when you got that mix and played it on a car stereo, it sounded like it didn't have any bottom end all of a sudden. So in some ways, that's the tricky part. A good mastering engineer knows how to kind of cut through the sound of his system and make sure that it's going to play well in the widest variety of environments.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get, before we finish, and we've still got a little while left, so I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about music servers, which is
that's the fun stuff there.
A subject near and dear to your heart, I know, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about that. We've been talking a lot about analog versus digital and so on and so forth. Music servers are clearly a digital source device, and I know that you've embraced them pretty strongly. Why is that? Is it a convenience factor? Have they gotten to a point where the quality is good enough?
Well, okay, it's an interesting point. I mean, you know, we were talking, you look at the big, you know, library full of records behind me, and you think that guy's an analog guy, and he's just going to be stuck in the dark ages the rest of his life. But no, the fact is, when CDs came out, I was a little hesitant at first, because the first CD players, I thought, did sound like a step backwards from analog. And I thought, you know, this isn't going to last in terms of an audio file format. So let's wait this one out. But they started sounding better, and, you know, stuff started coming out on CD I couldn't get on vinyl, and so I got into it. At some point, because I am kind of a music nut, and also I've worked in radio for years, so I get access to a lot of free music, I ended up accumulating thousands and thousands of CDs. Now, That was great. I had walls of CDs. The problem is, just like with LPs, I've got walls of CDs, and CDs are supposed to be more convenient, but all of a sudden I couldn't find stuff, and stuff I was buying, you know, I'd get 20 CDs in a day or two, and 10 of them would disappear, and I wouldn't hear them because I forgot where we put them, or we couldn't find them. And so it became an issue of managing all of that media. And so when music servers, well, I should start with iTunes, you know, one of the first mass market accepted music server software applications came onto the scene. You ended up all of a sudden with this opportunity to start organizing your media in different ways. And it wasn't a matter of physically moving stuff around on the shelves. You've probably seen that movie High Fidelity. I don't know if the listeners have, but where they make a joke about the fact that the guy likes to rearrange his record collection every couple months based on some new criteria, whether it's by genre, by the color of the spine, by the, you know, the color of the cover. But right. See, with a music server now, you can resort all your music into however, whatever way you want, really easy. So it was interesting to me that it solved that problem. But of course, then the sonic problem, you know, once again, did it make things sound better or worse? Now, if you think about an iPod is actually just a little music server. And a lot of people were, especially audiophiles, were really going after the iPod as this big step backwards. And the reason being is because generally people would download MP3 files and they didn't sound very good and they had crappy little iPod headphones and so forth. But from the beginning, the iPod could accept a full resolution signal. It's just that they didn't have a lot of space on them. So if you put a full couple CDs that you moved onto your computer at full resolution, even if you used Apple lossless compression or something like that, which is a lossless compression, you could have the size of the album. So instead of 600 megabytes, it was 200 or 300 megabytes. But even still, it would fill up real quick, so you couldn't get a lot of albums on there. But the iPod could still sound good, and John Atkinson did a review in Stereophile, put it on the cover, which of course outraged a lot of people, and he smiled gleefully at the opportunity to do so. But you know, the point being is that if you set the iPod up properly, you put uncompressed music on it, and you pay attention to how you get it into your system, it can sound pretty decent. And there's a phrase that I coined that I always like to use, which is, whatever the mass market accepts, the audiophiles then have to perfect. I mean, it happened with LP records, which were pretty, it's a physical, pretty clumsy format, but audiophiles perfected that. CDs came out and audiophiles hated that, but because the mass market accepted it, audiophiles eventually sat in on perfecting that, and we perfected that, I think, to a pretty great extent. Same thing with the iPod and with music servers. I mean, the first expressions of these things were low res. They had trouble handling a lot of data, but over the last few years, in fact, the last 2 years in particular, the amount of work that audiophile-oriented people have done on music server systems, on the different pieces of hardware and software, has been immense, and the results are wonderful. And so at this point, I'm fully converted. I mean, just to jump to the chase here, I'm fully converted to a music server system because it met the criteria of what I consider to be, you know, pretty darn good CD quality playback. But the convenience factor, this is where, you know, I talked about music quality and ease of use. Well, the ease of use on music server set up right can be immense. And the corollary result is it's actually gotten me way more involved in all that music that I kind of lost track of. So it started increasing my music appreciation. You know, for example, Scott, actually, I've got two of your discs and I've got one from your wife, Joanna. And so those are all of a sudden as easily accessible as my David Bowie discs. You know, they're all, depending on how I sort things, are all right there. Where, you know, before, for example, classical music was in its own part of the closet. We have, I've got a huge section of Indonesian music, and it was in its own part of the closet. And it was kind of tough to manage these things. But now it's much more easy to do so.
Mm-hmm. And you find the quality actually to be acceptable in lossless compression.
Correct. Yeah. And what's interesting is, you know, I say once again, whatever the mass market accepts, the audiophiles will perfect. You know, the mass market has shown that being able to download MP3 files, file trading, you know, starting with Napster and so forth, or even in a formalized environment like iTunes, these are lossy compressed files generally, which is not a good thing, but there they are. But as a result, it became a mass market phenomenon. Audiophiles have been working at creating a high resolution or a lossless or even higher than CD resolution a version of what iTunes is doing. So, you know, just to throw a company out there, HDTracks.com, puts all lossless music up on their website. And they've got quite a decent catalog. It's growing quite a bit now. They also do high resolution, and I mean higher resolution than CDs. So we're talking 24-bit, 96 kilohertz, or 88 kilohertz. So twice the red. Well, I shouldn't say twice because that's technically not correct, but much greater resolution than a CD uncompressed is now available as a download that you can purchase and download to your computer and play back as a high resolution. You know, if you have a high resolution DAC that converts that digital signal then to your stereo, all of a sudden we've been able to do online what they weren't able to accomplish, you know, with discs. The SACD format and DVD audio formats failed. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to get some hate mail on that comment right there, but still, they failed. And, well, you know,
They did. There's no question about it.
But I think one of the reasons they failed is because we tried to reverse the natural law of order, which is the mass market accepts, the audiophiles perfect. Well, with those two formats, the audiophiles said, let's perfect the disc and then make the mass market accept it. It doesn't work that way.
Interesting. Do you think that there's probably no way for the audiophile world to perfect lossy compression?
Well, you know, they try, and there's always the new version of compression. But at this point, why do we need compression? I mean, there's so much bandwidth out there, and quite frankly, hard drive space is so. I mean, for $100, you can get yourself a terabyte hard drive, which you can put 2,000, uncompressed CDs onto. You know, using something like FLAC, for example. And so, why would somebody want to compress it? In fact, what I'm finding when I'm talking to people and communicating about download and so forth is people saying, yeah, you know, I downloaded those five albums in MP3. I got to download them again. Now I'm finding the high resolution files. I'm going to have to download all the stuff I like again. And this is a point, and maybe I should be careful about saying this, but I boycott the iTunes store because they don't offer high resolution, truly lossless compression music. And so until the day they do at a reasonable price, I'm not going to download anything from them.
Other sources of high resolution audio we should mention include iTrax, itrax.com, whose owner and manager, I guess, Mark Waldrop was a guest on the podcast. He's also with AIX Records, which makes DVD audios, and probably do a better business with iTrax, with a download service, than they do with the physical discs. Another one is in Norway called 2L, the number 2.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a nice new one that I've seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, Lynn Records was one of the first out of the chute with some high-resolution files, too, that you can purchase.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Lynn, L-I-N-N, Records.
Oh, yeah, sure. Scottish high-end audio component manufacturer that also is a record label.
Yeah, they've been doing recordings for decades, so they've made them available online as high-resolution downloads as well. I want to make one point, though, about that, which is this is one of those things that's in flux right now, because if you look at what the iTunes store has done, it's basically pegged the price of a track at $1 or thereabouts. And I know that Apple has created this somewhat premium, you know, kind of version, but you've essentially created the economic equivalent of a $10 album on a download. A lossy, compressed download is the same price as buying the CD, which I think is unacceptable. And I think that at some point, and I know that record labels have their economics, and I've actually argued with people who record and run labels, and they've explained to me how this is a naive way to look at it. But I think music has a natural price range, and it's not free, but it's also not $12 an album. And I think we're talking half of the retail that Apple's charging in their iTunes store, and at double the resolution with no digital rights management. That's the point at which I think that we're starting all of a sudden to gain a proper balance between the needs of the consumer for an album that's reasonably priced, but also high resolution as a choice, and the ability for record labels to start putting music out that people won't instantly just want to go pirate because they don't want to spend $12 on a lossy download.
My next question was going to come off of what you just said about no DRM. I was going to ask, so you do not believe in DRM? But I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that DRM is unnecessary if you price the music in a reasonable manner so that people aren't tempted to pirate because they don't have to because they can afford to buy it.
Right. Well, we could talk for 4 hours on this topic alone, and I'm sure the readers, you're going to get 200 TWiT messages right now on this, but
sure.
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, in fact, one of the editorials I wrote like 6 years ago when I saw this happening was, I mean, of course, if you want to charge, and actually this is an issue I have with the high resolution sites we just mentioned, is I think they charge too much for the high resolution version of these albums. I mean, I realize that, yeah, there's a little bit more bandwidth involved. I realize that it takes a little bit more space on, you know, their servers to service that. But I don't see why you would charge $15 or $20 for a high resolution download for something that you would get, say, the low resolution download for $10. I know I'm naive about the economics of it, but still, it kind of inflames me that you would still want to spend or charge somebody rather that kind of money for something which is essentially a digital file that they get over the internet, and you haven't actually produced or created anything of physical value or distributed anything in any physical way. Mm-hmm. So the problem simply becomes then one of price elasticity, I think, from the record label point of view. And, you know, we don't want to get into economics, but the point is, if you could sell, say, 1,000 CDs at $1, or you could sell 10 CDs at $100, you still make the same amount of money. You still make $1,000 either way. But in one case, you sold 10 CDs to 10 people at $100 and 1,000 CDs at $1 to 1,000 people. So that's price elasticity, because the lower the price, clearly, if there's an unlimited market, then more people are going to buy it. The trick is, let's say you sell once again for $1 for this CD and you sell 1,000 of them. But what if the record companies find out that if they charge $20, they can still sell 100 discs. So in other words, by charging $20, they limit their market, but they make twice as much money. And see, that's the problem is if they think they can make twice as much money but sell fewer copies of something, they'll continue to do so. And unfortunately, that creates, I think, two tiers to the market. The one tier, which is the person who doesn't care how much it costs, they just want to buy it legally and so forth and so forth and so on, which is great. But then there's the other tier, which is just, in a sense, resistant to paying what they think are price gouging prices. So they will continue to look for those alternative ways to source files. And, mm-hmm. you know, for my own part, for example, you know, I won't download from iTunes, but what I do is I get on Amazon and I buy a lot of used CDs. I rip them into my music server, because used CDs on Amazon can be had for, you know, 1 cent to $3 to $5. New discs are showing up for $10. And here I've got a full resolution $10 release that on iTunes is half resolution for the same price. Mm. So I still think that, you know, the physical world, I basically fall into the camp of someone who is stuck in that old paradigm of shipping a physical product, largely because I think the pricing scheme is out of whack for the downloads at this point.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to a question by another question from, I misread it before, iPad1563, who asks, what settings do you use to rip your CDs to the music server?
Oh, well, that's an interesting point. I mean, here at my house, my listening room, I actually use a system called Sulus, which is a product. It's a music server product that you can buy. It's a touchscreen. It's what we call kind of an end-to-end system, where it's a touchscreen. It's got a computer built into it. It's got hard drives that you store in your closet that's connected to it. So it's kind of a closed system. I didn't create a homebrew music server for my main system, although I use a MacBook Pro with iTunes and also Songbird. Now, when I want to rip, so let me get back to the Sulus. The Sulus, which is spelled S-O-O-L-O-O-S, not to be confused.
Marketed by Meridian.
Meridian, which is a high-end audio manufacturer. Sulus is an interesting company because they were started a bunch of independents. These guys in New York had all these record collections, and they were ripping them onto the music servers and sharing music. And they kind of just wanted to make it easier to use. And so they figured out, well, the touchscreen interface is much easier to use than a mouse in iTunes. And one thing led to another, and they ended up with this really nice product, which they showed it in Las Vegas several years ago. Well,
at the Consumer Electronics Show.
At the Consumer Electronics Show. And I remember walking into the room because I'd been ripping stuff onto my computer in iTunes and some of the other programs. And I walked in, and here's this touchscreen with a beautiful graphical user interface. And it didn't hurt that they had a lot of cool music on there too. But I walked up to it, and they've got a couple thousand albums on this interface. And instantly, I'm finding everything just like that, split second, moving back and forth. The thing is instant. And I tell people, because on paper, this sounds like it's just an overpriced music server. But as soon as you get up and touch the thing, it beguiles you. So the point being is, once again, they created this solution that you basically put your CD into their touchscreen, and it rips it as a FLAC, F-L-A-C, for folks that it, usually it's if you look at it online, it'll be capitalized FLAC.
Do you know what that stands for?
Free, oh boy, I used to.
Free lossless audio codec. I'll bet you that's what it is.
Yeah, that's what it is. And so what they've done is they've standardized that for their system, although they will, the Sulu system will reproduce MP3s if you, you know, if you stoop so low as to put them into their system, as well as higher resolution, other formats. But anyways, they will natively rip everything as a FLAC file, and they'll handle all the back-end chores for you. It grabs the metadata automatically, so the album cover, the liner notes, the tracks, all that stuff just immediately goes into the system. But when I'm you know, putting stuff, for example, when I'm doing reviews of a DAC for Stereophile, I want to compare. I won't want to use just the Sulus as a source, so I'll use my MacBook Pro, which also is used as a source. So for that, what I'll do is typically rip something. Well, you know, it's interesting. I've ripped WAV files, AIFF files.
Both of those are uncompressed formats.
Yeah, uncompressed format. I've ripped things using Apple Lossless. I've ripped things using FLAC. And there's definitely some housekeeping advantages, but I'm going to kind of say the non-geek thing, which is the differences between those sonically for me don't matter as much as just how easy one might be to use over the other. Mm. But what I find actually matters most, more than that in terms of sonically, is which DAC you're going to hook up to your computer to get the music off the computer. So in the scheme of things, the codec I found, as long as it's a lossless codec and it's handled properly in the computer, I found that that matters a little bit less than the DAC that you use and the way that you get that music off the computer. So, I mean, that's just my position. Some people are going to say, hey, that guy's crazy. I mean, this codec works way better than this other one. But I have to admit, that's just somewhere I've decided not to focus my time.
Now, this brings up a question for me, which is, if you're comparing different lossless codecs, like WAV, yeah, totally uncompressed WAV or AIFF, or lossless like FLAC, how much difference can there really be in audio quality between them? They're lossless. It's bit for bit the same.
Yeah, except for, now, I'm not going to speak from my personal experience because I don't sit there and look at the digital bits as closely as, I mean, I'm going to defer to people who actually are experts at this and I'm not. Mm. But the way your computer converts that, because even if it's a lossless format, it's still, the data is still stored on your hard drive, and there's housekeeping, you know, chores that have to be done to get that data back out and timed and clocked properly so that it's played back to your computer. Those different formats will have slightly different ways of doing that. And so some people favor some versus the other in terms of they've got, you know, what you and I might consider an arcane technical reason why they might like one way of doing it better than the other. Mm. You know, with the Sulu system, they chose FLAC. And so basically I've encoded 7,000 CDs into that thing as FLAC files. And the nice thing is I've got pull-out terabyte hard drives. I've got like six of them. And so those FLAC files are universal. If the Sulu's company goes away, or if I decide to move to something else in 2 or 5 years, those FLAC files can be moved to the next thing. And, you know, I'm not stuck there. Now, you look at something like iTunes. iTunes does not actually handle FLAC files, interestingly enough. And Apple, for some reason, you know, prefers, I wonder why, they prefer you that use their Apple lossless codec. You know, you're kind of stuck in a corner there, which is why I use Songbird, because Songbird does handle the FLAC files, and there's a lot of high resolution labels that sell their files, like HD Tracks, for example. Reference Recordings has some great downloads, and those are available in FLAC files, and so I'll run those in Songbird on my Mac, because iTunes simply can't handle that format.
Go ahead.
Well, but I will say that, you know, one thing I like about the Sulu system is it does handle the multiple formats nicely.
So do you generally use an external DAC on your system?
Yeah. Sulu's originally, when it came out, they had a DAC that they sold with it or built in. And, of course, audiophiles were complaining that they gave them choice to choose their own DAC. And I agreed there. So the current system doesn't have the DAC built in. And so I've had a dozen DACs here through the house, and some sound better than others. I mean, these are really subtle details that we're talking about here, but you know, once you lock into what that detail is, it matters. And So, yeah, I'm kind of picky about which DAC I hook up to it.
I can understand where a DAC would make more difference, one DAC to another, because how you convert the digital to analog, what kind of filtering you might use or whatever, could, in fact, make a significant audible difference.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the most recent review I just completed was of a DAC that was around, $800. And so I compared DACs that were $400 to it, DACs that were $2,000, and one DAC that was several thousand dollars. And funny enough, the DAC that was several thousand dollars, it was the Air QB9, really sounded more like a master tape than the other DACs. And of course, it's the kind of price that a lot of people aren't going to want to shell out that money for just a digital audio converter. But it was a difference that made a difference. And so for somebody that's so focused on that, it's going to be the product that they're going to want to buy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, are you taking SPDIF, SPDIF out into this DAC, or how are you getting into the DAC?
Okay, out of the Sulus is SPDIF, but that Air DAC, interestingly enough, only accepts USB. So for that particular comparison, I use the MacBook Pro.
With USB out.
Correct, yes, right, with USB. So that was, most DACs have both kind of inputs on them. They believe that only USB can do what they want it to do. So I was comparing the Air to the other DACs with the MacBook Pro using both Songbird and iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I assume computers' internal DACs are not going to compare at all to these.
Yeah, best avoid it if you can do so. I mean, because the USB out is so convenient these days, an external DAC only has to cost $200 or $300 to get a good one. I mean, there's one of the ones I was comparing was from Cambridge Audio. There was Musical Fidelity, the VDAC, and these things start in the hundreds of dollars, and they sound instantly better than what you've got on your computer if you're inclined to go that way.
Sure. Got another question from F Loop, who asks a great question, actually.
That wouldn't be short for Fruit Loop, would it?
I don't know. he asks about the difference between objective measurements and subjective impressions in the review of audio components.
Yeah, you know, that's a tough question in the sense of, and there's a tangential issue there, which I don't know if I want to get into too much, but what's called blind listening testing. Objectively, you can take a component and you can measure it, and especially with something like a DAC. And in Stereophile, we do this, and that's one of the things that I really like about Stereophile is that John Atkinson, the editor, will put a component under measurement, and he'll take a DAC, he'll put it under torture test environment and try to find out what it does, try to make it kind of break, scream, see if he can, you know, catch it out somehow. But then there's the listening test, and, you know, the listening test, it's interesting. Generally, yeah, you can correlate what he measures then to what you're hearing. But, you know, for example, with that Air QB9 DAC, the difference is, you know, what is it that makes that one sound different than the others? I know I've heard Air argue that it's the, the jitter. It reduces jitter and so forth. So that's a measurement. You can reduce the jitter. Then can you hear the audible effect? This is opening up a huge can of worms is, you know, do you let your ears follow what your brain has told you is correct? Or do you just simply listen and decide which one you like better and then try to observe what physical parameters led you to like that thing better? It's a tough thing. Blind listening. I did want to touch on blind listening because when this debate starts up, people at some point invoke blind listening, which is, if you know that you've got a $300 product and you know you have a $3,000 product and you're doing a subjective listening test, so not objective, because objectively on the test bench, you'll be able to tell if one test's better than the other. And that's right. The end of the story. But subjectively, you're listening to the $300 DAC and the $3,000 DAC. Now, if you know which is which and you're looking at this $3,000 DAC, you might think to yourself, wow, that's an impressive $3,000 DAC. It's got to sound better. Therefore, you kind of, you know, bend your mind into thinking, yeah, it sounds better.
Right.
Does that, in fact, color your perception? Now, I'm going to argue that a good reviewer that has been listening for a long time and is trained, knows what they're listening for, kind of developed a regimen, is less susceptible to that. But still, the suspicion will be, you know, did that person consider the price of the thing as part of his subjective judgment?
We're all human, after all.
Yeah, we are all human. Now, but it brings an interesting point, and I've actually gone round and round in circles reasoning on this issue because I was trying to get to the bottom of it. I remember back in the 80s, I was at this listening test where they were doing a blind test on a huge audience of people at a Stereophile show in San Mateo, California. They had a room of about 100 people, and they had two high-end audio systems, but they had two different amps, a solid-state amp that was, I think, retailed around $800, and then a pair of tube amps that retailed maybe around $5,000. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't know which amps were playing at what time for the music, but they kept playing the same song back and forth. And we were supposed to guess which amps they were playing at the time. Now, in a review environment, usually you can see which amps you're hooking up. So you kind of, it's like leading the witness. You know what you're going to hear. You know, that's what people will allege. But in this particular testing environment, we didn't know what we were going to listen to, right?
Right.
So that was hidden from us. What was interesting was, when we all filled out our forms, we turned them in, and then they evaluated and told us how we did as an audience. And I think there was, if I could be wrong, there was like five pieces of music. Each one was played a couple times on the different amps. And we were supposed to say, you know, is there a difference? Is there no difference? I forget exactly which AB protocol they were using. But anyways, the point at the end of the day was they tallied them all up. And of the five choices, I don't think anybody got a perfect score. But two people in the room got 4 out of 5 correct consistently. And that was myself and another engineer in the room. And I noticed that most of the people in the room were informal listeners. They weren't professional people. This was a consumer show, after all.
So they were audiophile hobbyists.
But and you know, I'm just giving a sample of my listening test because I know that there's actually John Atkinson did do a study of the wider sample. But what was interesting to me was the industry people scored typically better than the amateur or the less interested, the informal people. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I realized, it dawned on me, a light bulb turned on in my head. I said, wait a second. We're not testing whether or not those amps sound different. The audience itself is being tested on how good it sounds. I mean, in other words, how good our hearing is. And so in my mind, all of a sudden it flipped the thing on its head. And an ABX test, a blind listening test, tells you nothing about the equipment under test. It just tells you how good the person who's being tested can hear. And so is that valuable? That's only valuable to the person taking the test. And so
that's right.
At that point, I said, wait a second, ABX tests, you know, no, they don't have a place in reviewing because all you're going to do is determine whether or not I can hear a difference and whether or not I'm in a sense, experienced enough to hear what the differences are going on in this situation. Mm-hmm. So this is not a test of the equipment. It becomes then a test of me as a reviewer. And on that basis, I have a lot of trouble accepting ABX or blind tests. Now, blind tests are used in medicine. They're used in a lot of areas very productively. The thing is, listening is a skill, just like driving a race car or, you know, pole vaulting. In other words, if you tested everybody on pole vaulting, some people are going to do better than others. It doesn't mean that, you know, that particular pole vault environment is good or bad, or that's a good pole vault or not. You're going to find out that if you took 100 random people and they all use the same pole vault, two of them are going to be really good at it because that's what they do, and the other 98 are going to suck. It doesn't mean the pole vault's bad. because it's a subjective thing. I mean, it's a skill. And listening actually is a skill. It can be a skill. It can be a skill that you can develop and get better at. And so that being the case, a blind listening test simply tests your skill at listening. And a real good listener will consistently be able to call out, say, two DACs back and forth. And an experienced listener will say they sound the same. Mm-hmm. Or say the system maybe is not resolving enough and they'll sound the same. So you haven't once again determined that one DAC is better, quote unquote, than the other. You've essentially tested the person taking the test and you've determined that that person can or cannot hear the difference.
You know, John Atkinson and I got into this on his appearance on the podcast when we talked about at another CES show, he and Michael Fremer were invited into one of the rooms at one of the offsite audiophile shows and they did a blind comparison with cables.
Yeah, cables are tough. That's for sure.
They're really tough. And yeah. It was the difference between a pair of $2,000 Monster speaker cables and, $10 16-gauge zip cord from the hardware store.
And the one I like is when they use coat hangers. They stretch right. out. I've seen this. They stretch out coat hangers and plug them in between the amp and speaker, and then they do the test for you.
Yeah, yeah. And they didn't know which ones, which was which when they were taking the test. But I think John, I think they both got 4 out of 5 trials correct. But in the larger scheme of things, the guy who was performing the test did a, conducting the test did a, he had like, I don't know, 60 some people go through there over the course of the show. And the vast majority of them could not do any better than chance. Statistically, he got a little better than chance. I think it was like 60% of the people got it correct. And John and Mike got it correct most of the time. So again, I think this does illustrate, as you were talking about, the fact that an ABX blind test is more a test of the listener's qualifications or experience, shall we say, than it is of the equipment itself.
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon, because here's what happens in an ABX test. You're in an environment maybe that you haven't been used to, or you're hitting the equipment under a testing environment. What I've learned just over time, is, in fact, in the recording studio, you notice this right off the bat, those little teeny differences, it takes a while to figure out what they are. Now, mm-hmm. if you take the test before you figure out what those differences are, you're flying blind. And differences between cables, I mean, I'll be one of the first to admit, they're subtle. And, you know, I would say 90% of what's out there is hype about cables. They aren't, one isn't good, what isn't bad. I mean, these are subtle things. And so if you want to successfully test between cables, you've got to figure out what those subtle things are. And for me with a DAC, sometimes I'll spend 2 weeks with a DAC listening to it every day, two different DACs, until I all of a sudden can lock into what the difference is. But once you hear what that little difference is, you can then hear it from there on out, you know, as long as you're brushed up on it, it stands out. Now, in the recording studio, this happens all the time, where you're recording an instrument and you're turning, say, the compression up a little bit, then down a little bit, then up a little bit. You can hear the subtle change just perfectly while you're in there recording it, right? Right in that moment. I'm sure you've experienced this.
Sure, yeah.
Six months later, you go back, you can't hear it at all. It's because you're not in that event. You're not right there. Your mind isn't tuned right into what the little thing is.
Right.
Six months later, I mean, I've tried to remix stuff 6 months later and try to figure out, what was I thinking? Why did I spend 2 hours on this setting? I can't hear it. And then I have to spend another 2 hours until I can hear it again. And then all of a sudden, it's the difference that makes a difference. And I think the same thing happens when I do these DAC tests. If I put two DACs in front of you and I put on a song, you're going to say they both sound the same. I don't care if it's a $300 DAC or the $2,000 DAC. I will say they sound the same. If I have those two DACs and I have them for a week in my system and I listen to them a lot and I can figure out with a bunch of different types of music, all of a sudden, aha, this is what makes them sound a little different. If I play this piece of music, like, for example, there was this cut with these last DACs from Santana with a lot of percussion. And with some DACs, the percussion kind of had the same high-end sibilant quality, where with other DACs, each one had a distinct sibilant quality. Now, it was subtle, but once I figured out that that was the difference, you could put a blindfold on me and I'll get 100% of the time. But up until that point, I would fail the test. And that's, I think that's my point, is the blind test, once again, just tests how ready you are to, in other words, how prepared you are and how careful your listening skills have been developed. You'll either succeed the test or you won't, based on that, not based on whether the equipment has actual intrinsic differences.
Well, but the equipment must have natural intrinsic differences, or even after a long period of time and becoming acclimated and lots of experience, you wouldn't hear any difference.
Well, I will say, going into it, I won't assume that they have a difference. It's for us to discover over time that they have a difference. I mean, you know, to be fair about it, there may be, in fact, two amplifiers or two cables that sound exactly the same to even the most critical listener. Now, you know, maybe we haven't developed the testing regimen. You know, until somebody could figure out how to measure jitter on a DAC, everybody said the waveform going in looks like the waveform going out on each one of these DACs. There can be no difference. But then somebody figured out, wait, some have higher jitter problems than others. And then all of a sudden we locked into what jitter does. We locked into what jitter sounds like. And now you can differentiate between these DACs, because over time we've learned how to measure better and we've also learned what to listen for. I mean, the classic example is in a recording studio when digital was first happening. You could change the sample rate of the recording, or let's say you're using a sampler, a keyboard, a digital keyboard sampler. Mm-hmm. You can adjust the sampling rate on those keyboards. Now, on some sounds, adjusting the sampling rate doesn't really make much difference. But on other sounds, like say a cowbell or a tambourine, a low
something
sampling rate
in particular.
Yeah, a low sampling rate sounds terrible. It's very hashy and trashy sounding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're making subtle adjustments in sampling rate, at what point do you notice a difference and what point do you not? And so I think that's where audiophiles have to just relax a little bit and just say, hey, I don't really care about those differences, so I can be happy not, you know, worrying about that $3,000 DAC. Whereas another audiophile may say, hey, look, I really care about that difference. They're both equally valid. They're both okay. And, you know, I almost want to say, let's just get along. But the point being is that I don't see this as a right or wrong kind of an issue. I think I see this almost as a know thyself kind of an issue.
Mm. That's very good. Know thyself. And
know thy audio self, I should say.
Yeah. I was thinking, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about some analogs, so to speak, in the video realm. For example, watching a single chip DLP display, either a front projector or a rear projector, there's this phenomenon called rainbow artifact.
Some people see them, some people don't.
Right. But as soon as you start, once somebody points it out to you, then it's hard to ignore. The same thing happens to me in movie theaters when I'm watching a film, an actual film projection, and every about 20 minutes or so, you get those real change markers, those little black ovals up in the upper right-hand corner of the screen.
Right-hand corner, yep.
And as soon as you start seeing them, you can't not see them.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm talking about is when you get two DACs, at first they always sound the same to me. But as soon as I hear what the difference is, then I can always hear the difference. And, you know, that's at the point at which then I start writing and I start saying, this is what I've heard and this is why. And I'll tell you, though, if you put me in a room with five different DACs and put me in an ABX test, I'll probably fail it the first couple times. But, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, some people won't be satisfied either way.
Words of wisdom from John Iverson. Thanks, John, so much for being on the program. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Scott. That was fun.
Good. Be sure to check out your job.
You survived.
Yay! Thank you so very much. Yeah. Be sure to check out John's articles at stereophile.com. And check me out at my online homes, ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com, which John maintains so very ably. You can also email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next Monday is Memorial Day, which Twit is taking off for a well-deserved break. So my next podcast will be recorded on June 7th at its new time of 1:30, right before Tech News Today with Tom Merritt, a new show on the Twit Network that I'm sure looking forward to when it starts on June 1st. My guest geek in 2 weeks is scheduled to be Tom Norton, another colleague of mine, a well-known audiophile and videophile who writes for both of our websites, all three of our websites, and has been doing so for the last 20 years. So I know he's going to have a lot of great things to say, and I sure hope you'll join us. Until then, geek out.